Okay, so thank you guys. Lovely to see you all today. So nominally, I was asked to talk about this paper from January with Herman, but I know that you guys have also, you've heard me give some talks here before, and Andrea recently gave one of these seminars. So I'm trying to phrase the results in that paper in the context of maybe things that you've heard about more recently from Andrea, and also just a general problem of trying to play with celestiallography and see if we can extract lessons that maybe we would have expected if it behaved more like ADS-CFB. So that's kind of the theme that I want to present what I'm going to talk about today. But just to make sure that everybody's on the same page, I'll have a little bit of a nice review of the celestiallography program. So first off, when I say celestial CFT, I'm referring to this program where we're trying to identify a holographic dual to gravitational scattering in asymptotically flat spacetimes, and that this proposed dual is a CFT living on the celestial sphere, so the night sky. So the synopsis of this talk is the following. We're going to basically quickly enough get through the fact that the point of doing celestiallography is that we're trying to reorganize scattering in a way that makes the symmetries manifest, and that these symmetries are really, there's a lot of them, and especially if you've seen Anna and Laurent's recent work, there's various ways of seeing even more of them than these original infinite dimensional enhancement. And basically, now what's going to happen is that there's a sector of the celestial CFT that is essentially just governed by the asymptotic symmetry groups, spontaneous symmetry breaking. And so this is called the conformally soft sector, and within the sector, we have a lot more power over the holographic dual. And so basically what's going to happen is the hope of this talk is to convince you, at least, or show you how we think that the sector has not just, say, the symmetry currents of the celestial CFT, but also can help encode signals of chaos if we treat this 2D dual as a dynamical system. So that's going to be where we end up today. But I want to focus a little bit on, when we go through, I guess, the setup for celestial holography, what ways can we kind of tweak the way we were looking at it to kind of lead us up to some of these questions that we run into when we try to look at this 2D dynamical system. So essentially, it'll look like the first part is a bit of a review, but let's try to focus on aspects of it that maybe, like we're not gonna try to say that like soft theorems equals these symmetries and whatnot. We're gonna try to jump to that a little bit and phrase it in a way that basically becomes the starting point for the story of like OTOCs and the celestial CFT, which basically boils down to understanding this boost basis and this Rindler evolution in a kind of bulk and boundary perspective. So that's going to be the kind of the emphasis of this review first part, and we're going to get to some fun stuff that's recent soon enough. Okay, so again, our task is to apply the holographic principle to spacetimes with vanishing cosmological constant. And so the goal of the first part of the talk that is a somewhat review, is to convince you that the celestial program is the best way of doing this. So in this program, right, the dual is going to live on the night sky. We're going to have operators for every external scattering state. We're going to have an in and out label, so that's why I color these like orange and green. And we're going to be basically trying to probe gravitational physics in this bulk in terms of correlators on this boundary. So how can we see that maybe that is the best way of talking about a flat space hologram? So first off, asymptotically flat spacetimes are, again, vanishing cosmological constant. Once you add matter, you're going to have non-trivial gravitational dynamics. So the metric isn't going to be flat anymore. You're not going to have all of the Poincaré asymmetries, but you're going to have still the same asymptotic structure. So in this context right now, I'm talking about no horizon. And basically, when I look at my whole class of asymptotically flat spacetimes, I still have this notion of the conformal boundary, where I have scry minus, where massless excitations would enter the spacetime, and scry plus, where massless excitations will exit the spacetime. And so this S2 cross-section is the celestial sphere, just to make sure everybody's on board with the phrasing here. And we'll still have this conformal boundary for this whole class of asymptotically flat spacetimes that we looked at here. So localized stress tensor, but vanishing cosmological constant. Okay, so now, right, we have this causal structure for our space-time, and we want to think about how would we go about trying to find a hologram. And so maybe there are two precedents that come to mind. The first example, I guess, the canonical one would be ADS-CFT. So we have the wrong cosmological constant for that. But in that context, we would try to find basically some CFT that has, like, the observables are now correlators living on the boundary of this configuration. So the ADS space time is in the bulk, the CFT are some boundary operators. And another example where we already have an object that's holographic is just the S matrix. So we have some sort of understanding of what the bulk theory is supposed to be. But in the end, if you are an S matrix program person, you might think, OK, I have this set of on-shell data for the scattering amplitudes. What consistency conditions can I impose on that and basically try to see what that means for consistent bulk dynamics? So in some sense, we kind of have these two precedents for a theory or understanding scattering and asymptotically flat spacetimes as being hopefully limits of these. So in one case, we're going to say that we can actually just rewrite the S matrix as our celestial hologram. And in the other context, we would eventually like to understand better how to get a flat limit of, understand the relation between the flat limit of this ADS CFT picture and our Minkowski CFT. So the way to merge these two pictures is as follows. Normally, if I would talk about a state in my space-time on a given Cauchy slice, I can think about taking that Cauchy slice and pushing it, say, to very early times and very late times. And when I do so in a manner that takes me actually to the conformal boundary.
Can you make a comment in some sense? There seems to be a distinction between this non-holography and ADS in the sense that ADS CFT you impose a boundary condition without no radiative flux.
Exactly.
So somehow the S matrix like the holography is much more.
It's going to be different.
It's much more dynamic.
It's exactly what I want to get to in a minute. It's basically, so what I'm just trying to pose right now is that we can reconcile the following two statements, which is that we have this S matrix we think of as basically this in and out on-shell data, and we can write it in terms of some sort of correlator of operators on the boundary, conformal boundary. So the conformal boundary is going to be different, and that's why it's going to be a very different system than ADS CFT. So, but what I was basically trying to motivate here was just the fact that the setup is similar up to the fact that you can actually see then, of course, because the conformal boundary is going to be null in a minute, that it's not the same as like the boundary conditions you would impose in this instance. So maybe, let's see, hopefully we'll be satisfied in two slides. Yeah, or this, I guess, this side. So all I'm saying right now is that basically I want to think of this the system as being equivalent to the S matrix, say. And so maybe that's what I want to say is the following. So if I have my in and out states, I've basically been able to prepare them as states on the conformal boundary. Now, when I'm doing that though, right? So a priori, depending on what state I give you, so I give you the S matrix, which is some plane wave momentum states. These aren't going to have a priori until I show you in the next slide. Any particularly nice support on the boundary. So it's a little bit different at first than talking about just local operators putting the conformal boundary. But precisely what Laurent was saying is that what I will show in a couple slides is that we can think about literally scattering like local operators or boundary limits of bulk operators put at these null hypersurfaces, which is like this conformal boundary. And then that system would be the analog of this ADS CFT case where we have operators sitting in the conformal boundary. But we're going to run into, it's like the lead up is going to be the punchline, I guess, for the first like half of the, or like third of the talk, is exactly going to address what Laurent is going to say. So I'm going to push that for that. Just a quick mention while we've taken our state for the in and out state down to the conformal boundary, you actually get something extra for free, which is that the support of the operators that you construct, say, for the in and out plane waves is actually simpler on the, than maybe you would expect. And that comes from the fact that to go to null infinity, I'm taking R large and taking U fixed. And in doing so, basically, my plane wave will be rapidly oscillating, and I essentially pick out a saddle point where the direction that I want the particle to head to lines up with basically its momentum. So there's a kind of localization on this night sky of where that momentum was heading to. And so in this picture where I've taken my state and pushed it out to my in or out boundary, and I really have an on-shell momentum state. Then I have this equivalence between operators smeared over a null generative sky and a definite momentum eigenstate. So essentially, I can write my S matrix right away for massless states, and similarly for massless states, I have something near I plus and I minus as some correlator of smeared local boundary limits of local bulk operators. So to the extent that I still have a local bulk operator near the boundary, I am fine. Okay, so this is the first kind of allusion to the fact that, right, the surface is going to be null. But on the next couple slides, I want to get back to kind of the distinction between, say, the Corollian people's point of view of how maybe one would handle correlators on a null manifold, and the celestial perspective. And what the punchline is going to be, might as well like say it now a little bit, is just how do we want to slice the bulk in the boundary? And that question will turn into some sort of alternate perspectives in these things. So what I first want to point out, just to make sure, because I'm going to end up referring to the metric, like these C components at different points, and super rotations and super translations, I just want to have that slide there. So we've got to the stage where we know that we can talk about our S matrix as correlators of some smeared right now, operators in the conformal boundary. Now, on top of that, we know how our bulk fields behave in that boundary limit, or at least that's the point of this whole asymptotic symmetry analysis and identifying the phase space. So, right, so the emphasis here is we want this guy. We know how to write it on the conformal boundary. And now we know how the fields behave on the conformal boundary. So I've just written Bonnie, Vandenberg, Metzer, and Sachs's gauge fixing and how the metric behaves as a function of 1 over r when I expand at large r near scry. And again, the whole point of, I guess, asking what are the symmetries of this configuration is that basically there's this interplay between what you've picked a good gauge, but what are the physical falloffs? And then what residual gauge transformation? So if I do another diffeomorphism that preserves that class of falloffs, I'm still in that class of spacetimes. And that's where you get these larger symmetries. But what's going to be fun about the celestial program is that you kind of hopefully can sidestep some of these nitty-gritties, because we'll see that basically, depending on this, like essentially if you look at, say, like Laurent and Anna's work versus other proposals for how to talk about these extra symmetry generators, some people will be like augmenting the phase space in a weird way. And so the hope of the celestial, like, okay, part of the reason why I'm gonna say the celestial is cooler is that somehow that's not the relevant aspect here, versus if you really did start from the Bondi perspective and you wanted to kind of push through this soft theorem, like this word identity thing, you'd be very wary of some of these subtleties. I mean, you should still be wary of them, but it would be like the starting point for you instead of something that you can go back and interpret it as. So just so that we know, when I say super rotations, what I'm talking about, essentially when you do this analysis of how your gauge fields are behaving near the boundary, you end up identifying this asymptotic symmetry group by seeing which of these gauge transformations have non-compact support, they make it to the boundary. And that modding here by the trivial symmetries which don't make it to the boundary is in my asymptotic symmetry group. And then because it's only preserving a class of spacetimes instead of an exactly like Minkowski space, it can be much larger. And so BMS has an infinite number of generators, and their infinity is just this free function on the celestial sphere, different translations of the U coordinate. And then you can also extend the Lorentz group to include local conformal transformations. So this is more for you to just, when I say super rotation, I mean this guy. So we know then also that we can do a lead derivative along that on this expansion of the metric. So that's what I needed for the rest of the talk. But now let's get to some fun statements. Yes.
Yes, it's a different way of saying this. Starts off by saying we have, as we go to infinity asymptotically fat, the Ekinol approximation, which says that there's only so bad the singularities that can build up if you consider two quanta going in almost the same direction near infinity.
Okay, so
in some sense, kinematics dominates and is only so bad that the singularity structure can be.
Okay, so maybe I think the audio might be a little bit funny, just so I make sure I understand the question right. So if I didn't interpret you right, like also call me out. So I agree that there's different singularities. For instance, I think the main singularity that I'm worried about normally is what happens at spatial infinity, because part of the story of thinking of it, this U evolution, is that you need to tie it into past null infinity. And I know that this Penrose compactification doesn't always can be singular in that sense. I thought you were saying something.
I agree, but
you were saying something about collinear singularity.
I'm thinking about singularities from operator products.
Yeah.
Close to each other, yeah, on the celestial sphere.
Yes, we want that.
but we don't want them to be too bad. Sometimes they're dominated by the kinematics of the situation.
So I think that at least the types of collinear singularities that we get are in are of the form that we expect, where basically once you include it's an artificial singularity in like a complexified Z and Z bar coordinate. So you still don't run into a conflict with like the fact that you don't expect collinear singularities in GR or sorry, in gravity, but you do want to look at the so that'll be another of the questions that I want to pose for motivating this paper with Herman, is that we need to understand how to basically continue off of this real surface. So everything I'm drawing here is in 1-3 signature, and technically our singularities are in like basically Z versus Z bar on the celestial sphere complex plane. Okay. Is that fine for now, or?
That's great.
Okay, cool. Okay. So now I'm also happy to pause around these next two slides because of Laurent's previous question, but this is the time where I think it's hopefully all set up to talk about it. I have this, I can do a Fourier transform, right? So what I said is, okay, I take this saddle point approximation and then my bulk operator H here is now this mode expansion of free fields. I take the saddle point, so I've taken the limit that X is going to null infinity, and then I got basically just a Fourier transform along one of these generators to get me one particular frequency. But I can just as well inverse Fourier transform. And now I can really think of just operators sitting at points on the conformal boundary. And I want to emphasize that these are literally boundary limits of my bulk operators. So to the extent that you expect the approximation where I'm doing quantum, like treating quantum gravity as a perturbative, like quantum field theory in the bulk, then anything that I need to say about operator products in the bulk in the limit that I go to this null three manifold, I can continue to say at scry. And if anything, I'm more likely to be able to have some sort of local operator description at the boundary, because basically I've pinned things down and I don't have to worry about like actual like quantum fluctuations of the bulk geometry when I'm pinned at the boundary. So what I want to say is my perspective is the following, is that if I were going to do Carolean physics, I would be looking at a different slicing of the bulk and boundary than if I was doing celestial physics. Now, of course, one could of course slice your space-time at constant time slices, like normal time slices, which I didn't show, and those always end up at spatial infinity. So when I evolve in time, I mean, obviously my slice will change, but the boundaries of it are going to stay put and kind of move an infinite amount of time here, and that's where the singularities at I0 are important. When I can just as well try to think of this null manifold and just look at, say, scribe plus, and then look at operators or the state on a cut of it. And that cut of scribe plus, so this is a three manifold, this cut is going to have this celestial sphere cross section of, so it's S2 cross R, R is now a null direction. And it would correspond to the state on some bulk slice that asymptotes to a fixed U cut. And now if I want to look at that state as it evolves in U, I run into a little bit of a difference again between ADS, CFT, and RS case, because essentially you can have flux laws where something leaves the space-time, and then now like the bonding mass decreases or whatnot. So there's a sense in which maybe what I would normally call like canonical charges aren't conserved, because we know that they're leaving through the boundary, and that's a very different boundary condition than maybe some sort of reflective condition you would have in the case that this boundary was just one component and was just this cylinder for the ADS CFT case. So the various issues that I'd say that you run into in this perspective is kind of the in and out, the fact that the time evolution, if you want to think of it that way, is this null coordinate. And then like the conservation laws also look a little bit weird, because they're more of like a balance law between things that you know left your space-time and then the state on the slice. So that's like Reju et al. When he talks about the holographic nature of null infinity, it's a similar setup to that. And the Carolean people, for instance, Donet had a recent paper with Romain and others on this perspective. So what you're doing for me is I'm taking the same space-time and slicing it with U slices here. And the celestial person, what they're basically doing is slicing my space-time at constant Rindler time. So in the sense that I'll get to explore more in a second. So if you have any questions for what I just said, well, I'm happy to slow down there because I know this is where the question was asked, but I think I hopefully resolved it by now. Okay, good. So U-cuts versus regular time cuts. Yes, so let's have some fun. So it's actually quite helpful to think about the fact that when I'm saying I am doing the celestial CFT, the CFT is living on this celestial sphere. And I would think of doing like some sort of like looking at states of the CFT as circles of the celestial sphere and evolving them with radial evolution. What am I doing in the bulk? I can actually ask that question. So nothing stops me from doing it. And you see that there's a little bit of a funny business because when you think of Rindler time, you normally think of the Rindler particle that's accelerating, constantly accelerating. So the issue is if I am a Rindler particle and I'm constantly accelerating, I'm in my Rindler wedge, and I really only reached null infinity at one point, and it came from another point. That's the antipodal. So in this diagram, right, I have to be careful. So if I am in strictly a plane where x1 and x2 are 0, then I would basically be, I didn't draw it here, but like in this Rindler wedge if I'm a particle that's accelerating. So once I now go to this null infinity limit and kind of a little bit more careful about the order of limits I'm taking, we're actually going to see that basically the Rindler time slice that I care about here is where it's Euclidean evolution. So you're outside the Rindler wedge. You're in the region outside the Rindler wedge and basically evolving from one horizon to the other. So let me just advertise a little bit why the celestial practice perspective, even though this is a very weird way of slicing your space-time, can jump you to a lot of the interesting results of celestial CFT. And a couple of them are as follows. So the first statement is that the soft theorems, it's like soft theorem equals Ward identity, quite literally comes from looking at the canonical charge on such a surface. And I'll show that on the next slide. Because you're slicing through the, if you start from a canonical equator of my celestial sphere and just extend that in the Minkowski space bulk, you'll see that you always have these in and out contributions together for those charges. So that's another thing that comes in nicely, and they will come in antipodally depending on how I start my configuration and then I look at the boost images of it. And the main thing that I wanted to kind of point out, which again is I think closer to relevance to the stuff that some of you guys work on, is that my perspective is that if we really can establish like the Andy as a state operator correspondence paper, to the extent that we can trust that we have some sort of notion of a radially quantized celestial CFT, then we would get, just from the representation theory, essentially a decoupling of primary descendants that would give us this infinite tower of symmetries. And that I'll go through each of these bullet points in the next couple slides because I think it's important. And what I want to emphasize in that context is if I really can say, okay, primary descendants decoupled, then because I have this free parameter for the delta, I'll be able to tune two values where I do have each of these towers. And that statement now I'm getting from just the statement that I have an ability, like a dictionary where I can do radially quantized celestial CFT. And that's equivalent to what would otherwise in the bulk be a whole bunch of checks. So first you'd want to know, like, is there a universal soft theorem on the F-matrix side of things? And then when it comes to looking at how the boundary is behaving, these values of conformal dimension are going to have some weird R falloffs. So am I augmenting my phase space with overleading things? All these types of questions. And so I think hopefully Andrea mentioned a little bit of the recent paper where we're talking about certain order of limits where we never actually necessarily leaving the standard phase space if we've done a saddle point first. But the point here is just that basically there is a lot of debate that can happen around these two questions. And like, so a stronger statement just saying like we have a radially quantized celestial CFT jumps around that a bit. And I think that's nice from the point of view of the fact that hopefully you could see the symmetries with different gauge choices and stuff like that. So something shouldn't be so dependent upon like using harmonic gauge and then seeing that, yes, there's a tower in harmonic gauge, but in bonding gauge, there isn't this infinite tower. Like, that's not good. So I think I want to emphasize that for the people who do work on W infinity stuff, that's why I like this perspective a bit. And so just let's go through each of them a little bit because I think it's kind of fun. Basically, all I'm doing is I'm taking a contour on my celestial sphere and I'm extending it into the bulk. And in particular, when I extend it, so this is, right, the celestial sphere is codimension 2. Along the boundary, I'm extending it just along the null generator. So I'm taking basically C cross R, where R is like the U coordinate, and similarly for the antipodal V coordinate. And what I have is that I'm saying that this charge acting on the state that I would define on that circle or that contour is going to be the canonical charge evaluated on that bulk slice whose boundary is now this codimension 2 surface, where that codimension 2 surface is codimension 1 on the celestial sphere, and then also extends along scry. So some fun, and the nice thing about that is that looked a lot more like maybe what I would expect in ADS-CFT, where I have the boundary charge equal to the bulk canonical charge, and the codimension 1 is coming from the fact that these... 0, 8, 3, 2, 0, 8, 2. Okay. Coming from the fact that the charges in a gauge theory would be codimension 2 versus in a field theory would be codimension 1. So that matching now matches with the added part that the celestial CFT is basically quotienting by the generator of scry to go from this 3 manifold to a 2 surface, where in that 2 surface we find a nicer organization and kind of avoid these issues of on the 3-manifold, how it would connect in and out, for instance. So that's, I'd say, what we're doing. And so that's one nice thing. And so because it's going to be important for the setup for the paper with Herman, that's the title of the talk, it's worth kind of just going through one example here, which is, okay, so here are my coordinates for my space-time near future null infinity. I do the same thing near past null infinity if I want to. Let's just start with the locus where I say that x3 is 0. So when I do that, I can see that this is solved for absolute value of z squared is 1. And so that's my equator on my celestial sphere. Now, if I take that surface and I basically boost it towards the North Pole or South Pole, then what I'll end up doing is basically looking at different cuts of constant absolute value of z squared on my celestial sphere. So it'll just basically foliate it like I would if I did exponential map to a cylinder time. So that's a nice picture, but again, the point here is that this is going to be Euclidean evolution on this Euclidean celestial sphere. And also it makes sense because in the bulk it's Euclidean because this is a Rindler time slice outside of the Rindler wedge. And just for fun, one can kind of keep in mind that any circle on the celestial sphere corresponds to some hyperplane through the origin with space-like normal. One can just look at the boost images of each of the things that I just said. So this standard x3 equals 0 is easy to see in these coordinates. And when I do a Mobius transformation, I map circles to circles in the celestial sphere. So that's one side. And on the other side, if I have this, so I would normally have, say, x3 equals 0 is some space-like normal. And I look at boost images of that. I sweep out, the normal direction sweeps out basically this De Sitter hyperbola. So this is kind of nice, but one thing that it does lead you to is the following question. So when I do radial evolution, it's not so innocent anymore, because if I think of shrinking that S1, which is the state, describes the state of my celestial CFT, down to a point, say down to the North Pole or down to the South Pole, what I'm doing is when I'm approaching it like that, I'm really taking this x3 equals 0 slice and boosting it towards one of the Rindler horizons or boosting it towards the other Rindler horizon. So you want to understand the state of the Rindler horizon. And so even though we've kind of ignored everything about like Rindler observers and like, wait, we're outside the Rindler wedge right now, one could worry, I guess, about what is the state on the Rindler horizon. That does directly affect even this normal celestial CFT with Euclidean time, because that's kind of like the starting point, like the operator at the North Pole. Okay, so essentially what I've done right now is go through highlights of a paper that came up after Herman's, but I like that it kind of ties back into some motivation for why the questions that we're studying in the paper that is the title of the talk are interesting. So the next couple slides are just again to make sure that I don't use terminology that I haven't introduced. So, okay, I've said that I have a Rindler time cuts of my space-time. That Rindler time is conjugate to Rindler energy, which is basically a boost energy in that case along the, like towards the direction of the North Pole if I was doing that foliation. But for each of my, yeah.
The one issue which I'm very interested in is whether there's at some point we bring in the thermal states.
Yes.
And everything connected to planet temperature.
Exactly.
Technically, is that in the mismatch between whether the integration over the boost Hamiltonian eigenstates is bounded or is from negative infinity to infinity?
Yes. Yeah, so what's going to happen is that right now, the thing that's going to happen is the following. So right now, we're going to approach it by talking about analytically continuing in Z, which kind of sidesteps this issue because essentially by going to 2-2, we have like now this like thermal, like we have a celestial torus, and so we can kind of wick rotate and think of that cycle as being like a temperature for us. But I agree with you that in principle, if I was going to talk about the Rindler vacuum, so like I'm outside of this, the celestial CFT story kind of doesn't, it misses it a priori, but doesn't miss it because it cares about it from the point of view of the Hilbert space. Like in that case, then yes, these guys really would be Rindler energies, and a Rindler vacuum would basically have like positive, like conformal dimension versus negative like lambda. So for us, all of our S matrix states are still going to be right now, I think, sums over basically a continuous spectrum of delta without any regard to the Rindler vacuum. So we're looking at it from the point of view of we're always going to talk about everything in terms of the Minkowski vacuum. But I think that one could try to tie in a little bit better to what extent this, like I would be more satisfied if I could understand how this discussion of like the Rindler energies and the Rindler vacuum for the Rindler wedge tells me about the state of the horizon. And then I can go forth with that with the normal celestial CFT and never worry about trying to take some weird limit of a three surface that's at the boundary of the Rindler wedge. Yeah.
I agree, but I think the physics is
yeah.
not that complicated.
Yeah, I know. I think it should be coming just from the Rindler time periodicity in the end too. Right? The same thing that's happening there with the fact that basically this frequency variable now, so I would have omega go to like e to the tau or something like that. I would have the periodicity in the Rindler time, but I can also, what I'm saying is I can also see that from the celestial sphere. So basically I avoid that issue in what I'm talking about, but I agree that one could unpack it better. So basically what I'm saying is that the periodicity in the Rindler time also turns into a periodicity of the Z and Z bar that gives you the celestial torus. And that's how I avoid too much worry about this state in the Rindler wedge. Yeah.
It's situated
then. Oh, yeah. No, it's like
the key to the whole thing.
Yeah. Sorry.
We can come back and talk about it.
Yeah, we can come back and talk about it. What I'm saying is I think that I have an equivalent route, which is that I can do my discussion in terms of understanding the celestial torus picture, have a thermal interpretation from that, but literally just do celestial CFT on this complexified celestial sphere, celestial torus, and get back a result because basically it's coming from in the bulk having this Rindler time like temperature for the if I was at a fixed value, the distance from the origin and accelerating. So
what you're saying is you can, in the ordinary case, you can get away from having to think about this too confusedly, like just going to the Euclidean case and then worrying about how you complete the boundary conditions for quantum states.
Yeah.
On the circles that are formed there. And here you have a similar trick
involving
going to the torus.
Exactly. So we have that just strictly from the G.
But both of them are leaving out the physics, which creates the thermal states, which is the fact that domain of integration.
Totally. I agree. No, I agree with that. And that's where I pause when you ask the question. Because as much as I want to, I can get to the same physics, but I don't have in my slides right now. And this is because, let's emphasize that I guess the way that Herman and I were doing it was just strictly looking at the 2D perspective and you kind of jumping to the fact that when I do this Rindler time evolution, I can look at the same evolution on the Z and Z bar and then understand the periodicity from the celestial torus that way. But we weren't necessarily, I guess, distinguishing inside and outside the Rindler wedge. And so from the way that I set it up so far in this talk, I'm talking really about, like, when I talk about celestial operators, I'm kind of in the region outside the Rindler wedge. And so that's where I've avoided trying to unpack the vacuum that the Rindler observer sees. But we effectively do take into account by this torus analytic continuation.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so now what I just want to point out is when I say celestial amplitude, I will mean that I take my ordinary amplitude and basically Mellin transform it, and this guy transforms a correlator of quasi-primaries under the Lorentz group. And so now from the point of view of these operators at Scry, if you just compose Fourier and Mellon transforms, you'll see that essentially this is just waiting with some I epsilon prescription operator smeared along generators of null infinity with u to like negative delta. So celestial operators have support all along generators of scribe for a given point. And so this is just changing the representation of Poincaré. And so what one sees is that when I do this Mellon transformation of the frequencies, instead of being in a momentum eigenstate, I'm now in a boost eigenstate, where when I say boost eigenstate in this context, I'm saying boosting towards the direction the particle is heading. And one can just see for the spin dependence, this is just like your standard little group transformation law for the external states. And now basically by doing this Mellon transform of the energies, I also pick up a weight for these overall, like so the absolute value of C, Z plus D. Okay, so Lorentz invariance is automatically giving me the ability to write my S matrix elements as correlators of quasi-primaries in 2D CFT, where this formal transformations are Lorentz transformations. But the kind of key point of the story is that these guys get promoted to Virasoro primaries when we couple to gravity, and a very nice paper that showed this was with Anna, so by Anna and Dan and others, I think, or definitely Anna. now the next thing I just want to say is that that's my holographic map, so that Mellon transform I've done is what I'll talk about when I talk about these operators. The plus or minus indicates in and out, and they'll have a conformal dimension chosen by me by that Mellon transform, and a spin that matches the helicity in this context. So the point is, because we really have this three manifold, and we've reduced it down to two, we do have a continuous spectrum of weights. And in this manipulation here, I don't want to talk about like half of them annihilating the vacuum or anything like that yet, because I do want to be able to essentially try to deform my contour here and talk about values of the conformal dimension that are not going to be on the principal series. So the fun that I have is the following. So so the reason why celestial CFT seems to give you these nice extra symmetry for free, in some sense, maybe not for free, is because I have this freedom to analytically continue my conformal dimension. And so when I do that, for a given spin, I can always choose a delta so that I am at a primary with a primary descendant. And one can see for the case of 2D, it's really simple to see where the primary descendants occur. So the primary condition is that it's annihilated by these Lorentz generators. And then a primary descendant means I also want it to be primary, but it's a descendant. So I descend with L negative 1. And then I want this to vanish. And so I can just solve for basically H is 1 minus K over 2, where K is a positive integer, and similarly for L bar. So for this talk, I'm not going to go through the whole celestial diamond interpretation of each of the corners here. But what I want to point out is that we have now, because we have this free parameter of delta, we can kind of tune our correlator to a value of delta where you have a primary descendant. And if you really did have a radio quantized celestial CFT, you'd expect taking some derivatives of that would decouple from the correlator. And so the distinction here is that not only the hermeticity conditions of generators in the bulk do not match what you'd normally have for the generators in the radial quantized CFT. And so this is where a priori, it's like the physics is, or the results are pointing you towards trying to make that work better. In the sense that I'll list a couple examples of where we're basically using techniques from radial quantization and getting it to work for us. And we do see that from the soft theorems, just the form of the soft theorems is essentially a Green's function for these descendancy relations. And so you can see that if you do take that number of descendants of, say, a soft graviton or a soft gluon, that you essentially get contact terms where other hard operators that are charged under those symmetries, are located. So we get the feature that would be kind of guaranteed to you if we really did understand how to do radial quantization in celestial CFT. And so the first step, I guess, towards understanding that, or like saying that it has to work, I think would be this paper by Andy and his grad students about the state operator correspondence. But I think that given these discussions here, there's some ways to revisit that and just like shore it up from the point of view of the bulk and the boundary too. Okay, so what I'm saying now is that I can tune my delta so that I can pick up, say, any of these infinite tower of operators that now have primary descendants. So if I take some number of derivatives of them, it's a finite expansion in Z bar, say. So the fact that this terminates is the statement here that there's a primary descendant. And now these guys here, these basically mode expansions of my operators, these special conformal dimensions, are giving me this really rich symmetry structure that Andy and friends, and then also Anna and Laurent have looked at in a different way. And so another thing I want to just point out here, because this radial equals Rindler, is we are basically using this complexified kinematics, so with, like, taking Z and Z bar to be independent, to look at collinear singularities in that complexified sense of gravity. And then from that, getting this, using these radial quantization techniques to extract what we would call a radial quantized commutator, and getting now these mode algebras. So the point of this talk for this slide for me is that, okay, celestial CFT, like, once we understand radial quantization, and I think that this will tie in a roundabout way to what Lee was kind of hinting at, only because, sorry, let me think why I would say that. I want to say that because basically I have for you that the charges are the same, and that I know how the Boltzmann boundary interpretation of the charges, and I know the boundary interpretation of this commutator, or this radial quantization commutator. I've just defined it. It's not a priori a commutator in Rindler time, but I think that if we really did understand how we're doing Rindler time evolution in the book, we would have a better picture. Like, it would kind of like to be a nice linchpin to what I'm going to discuss as the conclusion of the talk with Herman. So basically what I'm trying to emphasize here is that there's a couple of subtleties with thinking about radial evolution that kind of enrich our understanding of the hologram and of the results that we have already, that I still like little kind of small open questions that I think are going to be some fun things to think about, which is good for anyone interested. Okay, so one question that comes about here is, how do we analytically continue in Z and Z bar in order to extract a collinear singularity and gravity when we normally don't have an actual collinear singularity if Z bar is Z star, in the sense of like going to like R goes to zero there if Z is R EDI phi. Okay, so good. So what did I want to talk about on those previous slides? I wanted to get to you the fact that we have lots of symmetries, and these symmetries are symmetry enhancements of the bulk. I didn't have any horizon yet, but when I have symmetries, I should constrain physics. So why can't I try to constrain more interesting processes like black hole evaporation? So this is a bit of a pivot to the part of the talk that is like the brunt of the celestial CFT chaos result. So if I have any more questions here, maybe I should pause for that, but otherwise I'll just push ahead. Okay, so basically what happened in this previous, so this one paper with Herman maybe a year ago, we were looking at a question without any celestial CFT in it. We were just looking at to what extent we can play around with soft hair that you have from super translations. And in the process, we were basically noticing that there's a, super translations can be thought of as capturing non-trivial back reaction, which is associated with the Lyapunov behavior. And so I'll go through that in a couple slides so that we understand why. So I went through celestial CFT, and I emphasized so far that radial quantization equals Rindler evolution is going to be important for what I care about. That's going to be the key ingredient for why I can merge the celestial CFT story into this result with Herman, which was just looking at super translations and near her horizon. And one way to think about it, though, is that, okay, so for each of these symmetry generators I've written down, there's actually a symplectic partner mode that maybe we've kind of ignored. So they want to always think of two modes for every value of the conformal dimension where I talk about something interesting happening. So in the case of super translations, you basically have the shift happening at the same order in R as the a dynamical change that happens when I have a gravitational wave passing through and my masses move, and they remember that the fact that something happened. So that's just what I'm saying here. I have some infrared binding cistern and emits gravitational radiation. I have a detector that has a set of masses sitting somewhere. The radiation comes through, those masses move by a bit. That's my standard gravitational memory. I see that as an imprint in the fact that my metric now has a shifted value. So let's just keep in mind this notation here for an F plus and F minus, and I'll draw it in a Penrose diagram so that we keep track. So in my standard Minkowski space, now I've not doubled my Penrose diagram because I'm not worried about antipodal matching right to the second. I would have my boundary value of my metric, so like leading, say, behavior of CZZ near the boundaries of Scry, can take two different, say, values. the difference between the two would be a memory effect, while individually the zero modes would all shift under a supertranslation. When I add in a horizon, I similarly have a null boundary component. And people can ask, what are the asymptotic symmetries associated to that boundary? And one should be able to understand how if I did a supertranslation of everything here, and I really did gauge fix enough that I know how that should act on the bulk, throughout the bulk, so I should act also on this boundary, then basically the BMS invariance would be simultaneously supertranslating all of the boundary components, while I also have CPT invariance, say, doing this antipodal matching condition that Andy does. And what I get here is now, if I have this horizon, this doesn't knock me all the way down to zero. So I still have an extra supertranslation mode, even if I tried to fix my BMS gauge. So there's a story where you don't need to think about dressing all of your external operators, and a story where you see what happens when you do. So the point that I'm just saying here is that in the context of a horizon, I can fully remove my supertranslation ambiguity by dressing my operators, but still have a degree of freedom there because of the relative supertranslation of the horizon. Sorry.
Just a question.
Yeah.
Before you were talking about this,
yeah,
soft modes,
yeah,
hard,
yeah,
just
clean
at infinity.
Yeah.
Now, the horizon, can you comment on that?
Yeah.
It's a bit more
complicated. So at the horizon, it should be more complicated, but we are still looking at the future and past limits of the horizon. So it's sort of some, like, we assume, I guess, some sort of like quasi-static or adiabatic change of the horizon, so that for something's happening and then it's kind of stationary, and in that time frame we can model it.
So is it still like a perturbative treatment of the horizon?
Yeah, it's definitely making some assumption. Let's think about what, like, so in practice, what they're doing when they find these symmetry groups, right, is they're looking at the near horizon geometry and then seeing what preserves the behavior of the metric in that near horizon region, in the same way that one would do at null infinity. And then one can identify some notion of a super translation and super rotation, although it's a little bit different than if you took like short Schwarzschild and extended it to the boundary. But for me, I'm going to actually try to avoid using horizons at all in the following thing. So that's where, if we get stuck on this and we don't agree on it, it's fine. But for me here, I just want to be able to say that if I do a super translation and I really think about doing it on my spacetime and not just in some sort of coordinate choice, like a patch here, once I know how to like glue from one patch to another, so I have some sort of, what's the word, atlas or something like that, of just a bunch of coordinate patches that together tile together to cover my manifold, that when I do a super translation, I should be, like, the symmetry is doing it for everything. So I want to know how to do that when I've gauge fixed near this boundary. And so just from that statement, I should have a notion of a super translation acting on the coordinate system there, because I basically want to not artificially have gauge fixed different parts of the space-time independently. That's not a very satisfying answer to say that you can clearly identify the super translation. So I'm kind of reverse engineering like the fact that there should be something there versus saying that it's easy to see that there's like a softer or hard part. So I'm not saying that. But for me right now, all I need, because, okay, so let's also say, so long as I have this type of thing, I think I should be able to tie in the fact that, okay, I do need probably basically a difference between the horizon state here and there. So let me think if there's any way to say, like, people have done this analysis for me, so I'm just using that. But I do think the assumptions here probably are a little bit more like, in the same way that we would expect at Sky to have like nothing coming in or leaving early on. So at some point, maybe there's something where you would think this should be, when this is forming, it should be trivial or something like that. I guess I agree with, I'm sympathetic to revisiting any sort of splitting or anything like that. But I do think the actions of the symmetries should make sense, have to make sense from this patching condition. And then someone already basically gave us the asymptotic symmetry analysis here to basically be a little bit more glib about the fact that there is a future and a past value of that same parameter. So that's fine for me. And it's fine for what I need in this talk, but we can also talk about it more like maybe after or now, even if you have a particular complaint, it's fine. I don't think I need a splitting right now. Okay, I'll see. So the way that I would dress is I would take whatever mode that I have left. And so right now I've just written F hat, but I really want to allow myself some freedom of which F hat I use. I just need some operator that I know shifts under super translation. Now, of course, we know that because the super translations are doing U, like, so like it's changing the value of U as a function on the celestial sphere. Basically what happens is this quantity, say V minus F hat, or similarly U minus F hat, is going to be invariant under a super translation because you change a coordinate and you shift this F hat mode of the metric. And so formally speaking, a kind of cheap trick to dressing these operators is to just basically replace my U dependence in the plane wave, say, with a combination that we know is invariant under super translation. And so one can do that. And I just wanted to give enough of a outline of the computation to see where this chaos signal, quote unquote, was coming from a story. And that was coming from the fact that if we choose to dress, because we said that there's now these two modes left over for this horizon story, if we chose to kind of dress two different operators with different in and out values of this F hat, those no longer will commute with each other. And so here, yes, you can see that the fact that I have, I'm not in Minkowski space anymore, will change this leading, if I'm near the horizon, commutator. And in that near horizon region, you can see that if I'm dressing in a certain particular nice choice of ways, I would pick up the Lyapunov behavior just coming from the dressing. And so what the intuitive point here is the following, is that if I say that, okay, I have some sort of signal coming in as a shock that shifts my horizon, and then the fact that the horizon's now moved has a drastic effect on another observer. Well, in some sense, basically what these super translations are doing anyway at infinity is already kind of what, is already kind of that. They're measuring the imprint at infinity of energy deposition going through scry. And so to the extent that you would expect, maybe that's the same thing happening at the horizon, that would give you some good intuition for why it's possible, possibly that these Goldstone modes, so that's like these zero modes for my super translation, but like tied to one frame at the future limit of my horizon versus the past, can capture this Lyapunov behavior. It's capturing that back reaction. So for the point of this talk and like the paper that I'm focusing on, what I need from the first part of the talk is that radial equals Rindler. What I need from this part of the talk is that these zero modes that are in this conformally soft sector can capture back reaction. So those are the two things that I need. And then I'm going to try to find a way of, so like the attitude that I have here with some of these recent papers is basically trying to have fun with, can we see if we can make our celestial CFT have features of CFTs that we're maybe more familiar with in another context. And so we're trying to basically like play around or push at it as a dynamical system. And so, yeah.
Maybe a question. Yeah. Can you say a bit more about the M dependent?
Yeah. And yep. Good. Okay, so what I'm doing here is I am using essentially this, sorry, it's all coming from this coordinate transformation here. So I didn't know if I had showed enough of the equations to help you see that this is a leading term a priori, but basically what I'm doing here is I am using, so I have a future, so this horizon is this future horizon here. Not this guy. So in that context, then I'm still using coordinates that are, I guess, more favorable to infolding coordinates. And so that's why I give this asymmetry between how my V coordinate looks versus my U coordinate looks I'm going to use tortoise or some the wrong word there. But basically what's now happening is that if we ignore this term set, so we get rid of this guy, gamma here also depends on M. So I feel a little bit bad that I didn't show that. So now I would just normally have my U and V with just this dressing here at null infinity. Say, but when I'm near the horizon in this coordinate system adapted to falling through the horizon, I have this additional term. And then you can see that this term would dominate in the region near the horizon. So if I have basically a setup where I have these operators here that are aligned so that they are intersecting essentially at a point close to the horizon, then the term that would dominate in the commutator, which would be normally the commutator of this full thing and this thing, is not the commutator between here and here, but the commutator between here and here. And this is giving this exponential behavior. And so, sorry, just another thing to keep in mind here, when I say P in squared and P out squared, I'm saying that O in and O out are plane waves of these coordinates. So that's how I'm evaluating it. Is that fun? Yeah. Okay. So what I need from this is just maybe an appreciation of the fact that we saw signals of chaos coming from dressings. And this, those dressings we know were associated to supertranslation symmetries. And so more generally, we have this tower of symmetries, and we have like some notion of dressing off for superrotations, for instance. And so can we kind of try to engineer a situation where we would have interesting O-talks in celestial CFT? So that's going to be our goals. Like, what can we do to celestial CFT to make it behave in the way that we want it to? And in the process, we're going to have some fun talking about maybe some assumptions that we make about like the value of the central charge in celestial CFT, et cetera. So we're going to have fun with that. So, okay. So the point is the following. So I could try to go and I could try to take all of my celestial CFT operators and add another index corresponding to the state of the horizon. But then what if I'm trying to say that eventually it'll all evaporate? So I really just have no, like I just have my scribe plus and scribe minus in the end. You don't, that would seem a little bit weird from the point of view of celestial holography, where we really have everything just pinned down to the boundary. And so the way to not have to deal with these issues now is to think about the fact that, okay, if I was saying that the supertranslations were essentially capturing a back reaction of a horizon because something fell in, then the horizon moves, so the other operator is like, whoa, this is a very different situation. The same thing can happen in Rindler case. So if I send some energy through the space-time, Rindler particles, Rindler horizon will shift, and that can have a drastic effect from their point of view. So we're just, this is more of just a teaser slash motivation for the fact that, okay, I have celestial CFT. It's basically pinned down to the notion of looking at this evolution in Minkowski space-time or astronomically flat space-time in terms of Rindler evolution. So the fact that I can have some drastic effects in similarly operative behavior for a Rindler horizon being shifted by some shockwaves makes me think that maybe I can try to look for this without having to talk at all about horizons. So this is basically a little bit of a cop-out to maybe some more interesting physics, talking about like black hole evaporation from the point of view of celestial CFT more generally. But our goal here will be to try to use the lesson learned, which is that these, we can look to the IR sector, this informally soft sector, to try to find our harbingers of chaos and just see what we can do with it. So throughout the talk, I tried to put little questions in orange as they came up where one should be wary. So the first question that I had was, what is the state of the Rindler horizon? And we saw this just from the point of view of literally being totally outside of the Rindler wedges and looking at radial evolution of the celestial CFT as Rindler evolution in the bulk, but with this funny Euclidean time coordinate. And so when I looked at the limit where that circle went to zero, so it like either shrunk towards the North Pole or South Pole, those were the state at that point would correspond to, say, the Rindler horizon there. And so that was where that question came up. The next question that came up was, okay, well, I said that I have all of these nice symmetry currents and that celestial CFT seems to have a stress sensor, so it really does look more and more like could be this some local 2D CFT, like at least has like the first evidence of that, which is this candidate stress tensor. But what is the value of the central charge? So what representations do you have of these things? And then finally, when we came to this question of basically talking about OPs from like collinear singularities and gravity, and we need to analytically continue Z and Z bar to be independent complex variables, this question also comes up. So in each of these guys is basically kind of different subsections of, say, this paper with Herman. What I want to do is I want to follow a particular route because of an interest of time that basically focuses on the celestial back reaction associated superrotations. And then we're basically going to be focusing on, I guess, the second question in that context. And it's a route through the paper. So the result, we'll get to the result, but there's other ways to kind of go back and try to check it using kind of interdependent, but more like CFT techniques too. So, okay, first, our candidate stress tensor is normally written as follows. We have a superrotation symmetry, which I'd written on a previous slide at least. And the value of the soft charge for a choice of superrotation with pole gives me its candidate stress tensor. And so what it looks like is from the point of view of these drawings of like operators supported on null rays, I have a delta equals zero Mellon primary that gets shadowed, and that is my candidate stress tensor. So now that guy is symplectically paired with the superrotation Goldstone mode. And so if I just took my metric and I do a superrotation, I will shift the angular part of the metric in a U-dependent fashion here, where this part that I strip out the U power can looks like a Liouville stress tensor. So basically, I have two modes. I need to be careful about both of those modes. So if I just do a mode expansion of my charges, so I take my charges as some smearing of the stress sensor, they should obey an algebra consistent with the this bracket for the super rotations. But I also have that if I act the Q-soft on my super rotation Goldstone mode, I will shift it similarly, and I shift it inhomogeneously. And so if I do a Laurent mode expansion of my standard celestial stress sensor, which is that like the soft graviton, something soft graviton mode, and I do the same thing for the Goldstone mode for super rotation, then I get the following algebra. So I have a centerless Virasoro symmetry here, and this is the one that you normally see in OPE papers. And then I also have this term, which is not, it's not a Virasoro algebra, it's like it's just acting with a Virasoro symmetry on a generator similarly modded. And there's this term that looks like it wants to be a central extension, but isn't yet. So there's two ways to try to make that into a central charge. First way that we do that is we kind of, let's think about if we have a small parameter that deforms our algebra and then gets us to this combination. So we have L plus and L minus that I've defined here, with epsilon being a small parameter. And if you take the epsilon goes to zero limit, you indeed, at the expense of adding one commutator that vanishes and the epsilon goes to zero limit, reproduce this algebra that you expect. But a priori, it's kind of a little bit BS to like just say, oh, I like, let's deform our algebra with IR cutoff dependent, whatever thing, and say that this is going to be what happens. So I don't think you should be satisfied with this, but I think it is kind of cute. And one thing to point out is that you would not see this type of, like if you try to play around with how much freedom you have to do this, and like you have more freedom, or not more freedom, but you have more constraints in the context of a non-abelian symmetry. So if you did it for super translations, you wouldn't really have any nice way of pinning down what combinations of the Goldstone mode and the memory mode you want to look at. But you already do see evidence of this in like the papers by like Nan and Andy, and similarly Himwich and others with the leading soft graviton. Basically, they run into similar combinations of Goldstone and memory modes because of it seems like a naive overcounting of the number. Like we have kind of two types of stress tensors here if we took it too literally.
So
I didn't draw it's theta n and theta n would be zero in this context, and in this case it's proportional, so like epsilon it's a epsilon dependent thing that goes away, so hopefully quite far. We assume it's zero here.
Oh, theta was theta is
zero.
But it's also a stress tensor, so it suggests that maybe
we want it to be like, we want it to be anomalous, or whatever. We want it to be proportional to the IR cutoff, basically. We want it to be theta is like epsilon t or something like
it.
We don't have any evidence for it from, so we do not a priori from here have any evidence for that commutator being non-zero. We have the algebra kind of being so restrictive that like one can kind of guess the simplest, you know, Neuwirner type contraction to extend this. And what I do want to point out though is that there is a better motivation, I think, from this if we use ADS3 CFT2, which is I am now, instead of doing my constant Riddler time slices, I'm doing constant x squared foliations. So these are now spherically symmetric. If I do a hyperbolic foliation of my Minkowski space, like de Boer and Solodukhin did, then when I do a super rotation, that action is tangent to the leaves of that foliation. And one can see that if you do a finite super rotation, you really do basically have like a Benedos geometry on those leaves. And if I did just a super rotation, I should do the same thing, say, inside the light cone or outside the light cone. And so I really would only have like 1 degree of freedom there. But if instead I was doing some holography on my ADS3 CFT2s, then I would naturally maybe think of, let's cut that off with an IR cutoff. So set the radius equal to 2 over epsilon. And I would have basically two regions I need to care about. I need to care about the one near I plus and the one near I zero. And those guys would have the same algebra here. So I think it's natural to think of this epsilon parameter as coming from this IR cutoff, but to basically better understand that one needs to think about how one is chopping off my space diamond. So that's where someone like Laurent, who does like finite causal diamond things, would actually maybe have a very, like, would be able to get a theta-theta commutator, because we can basically get something here. So I'm up into that. And so I will be brief in the interest of time. All I want to say now is that if you do, once you have this algebra, one can basically imagine a sector where this one of these two is the central charge. So it's an imaginary but large central charge because I'm taking epsilon to zero. And when I do that, not only do I have a system now that has large central charge, but I also know what that sector would mean for me. And that would basically mean that I'm taking my theta term to be related to my stress sensor. So essentially I have a relation between the choice of the Goldstone mode around an operator and its weight. So I'm introducing a defect. And that's exactly what a super rotation normally is. So a super rotation, a finite super rotation, introduces either a bulk cosmic string or a defect on the boundary. And in this case, I'm saying that the defect is related to the weight of the operator in this context. And so when you do that, one can look at the Rindler, so these complexified Z and Z bar coordinates, and look at monodromies around them due to, once I say that this is kind of the behavior of the dressing operators. And that's how one quicker route to try to get this Lyapunov-like behavior for these Rindler OTOCs by formally looking at just the fact that I've said that I've looked at a sector of operators where I've imposed this back reaction where the Goldstone mode is related to the stress sensor mode, and therefore I have a deficit angle when I move operators around each other. So this is the route to the punchline that I wanted to convey here, because it leans into this question of the central charges and the super rotation Goldstone modes. And so in the interest of time, let me just wrap that up really quickly. This is my last slide. One can do the same thing. So once, if one is convinced that one has a large central charge system, now whether it's clear to see why one would like dress with a minus or a plus, or whether there's really both operators there, and you shouldn't, are you imposing some sort of constraint, or you actually want to remove one of the two Virasoro algebras, or you want to leave them both there but look at a sector of the three? I think there's some room there. But if once we do have some sector where there is essentially a large central charge, you can also just formally write the 2D conformal blocks and look at the same type of, going to the second sheet and monodromy properties of those blocks to repeat what would otherwise kind of be like the Poorman's approach of just looking at the deficit angle as I move an operator around. And so in this context, I want to point out that if I wanted to go back to Lee's question of trying to see when I have this maximally chaotic dynamics that I'm trying to claim is there, there really should be some sort of like thermal CFT. And the claim here is that that can be connected to the radial evolution being thought of as Rindler evolution, but now the radial evolution is going to be complexified. So I have to really think about the celestial torus cycle as giving me a sign of a temperature, even if it's like a unit temperature. But I didn't go too far into that today. So one can make sense of that temperature via that, and there's a lot to discuss there. But what I wanted to point out for the point of this talk is that basically, even though we're looking at a sector that supposedly is completely governed by the symmetries, the question of what representations we want to use, the role of IR regulators in that context, and the behavior under analytic continuation are kind of fundamental questions that pop up. And in this context here, not just for understanding this temperature for the Rindler observer, but also to understand crossing between in and out. So essentially, once we know how to go from 1.3 to 2.2, we should be able to go around from in operators to out operators and understand that a little bit better. And so essentially, these are all kind of basic questions about celestial CFT that we've gotten even in just the simplest symmetry sectors. I mean, they're all kind of related to symmetry, but this one is a bit broader. And then we see that in doing that, we run into a bunch of different requirements for what we would say is a nice toy model for the physics we're interested in. We wanted to have a Virasoro symmetry. We wanted to have now a W infinity symmetry of this whole tower. And now we also wanted to have maximal quantum chaos. And so that's just an advertisement for this SYK, mapping SYK is the sky paper with Herman, where we went with that starting point to try to see if we could construct a model. But that's all I have, time for. So thank you guys for listening. Very much. So.